Hello, Tomorrow Built Today listeners. This is one of your co-hosts, Jana Mesher-Smith. For those of you new to the podcast, we cover investing trends and predictions along with discussions about the latest news in tech. This week, we are bringing you several talks from Lightspeed's Enterprise Scale Summit that took place recently in San Francisco. You'll hear firsthand from industry icons in the enterprise with their tips for successfully scaling a company. One note to keep in mind is that because we recorded this live, which included a lot of hand gestures and animation from the speakers, the voice quality isn't perfect, but the content more than makes up for it. Please sit back, enjoy, and be ready to take notes. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Chuck Robbins, CEO and Chairman of Cisco, and John W. Thompson, Lightspeed Venture Partner and Chairman of Microsoft. Lightspeed has always been a big fan of Cisco. We count three former Cisco employees among our investing partners at Lightspeed.
Our next speaker is a very special person. He's none other than Chuck Robbins, who many of you know, and he needs no introduction. But let me give you a little context about Chuck. I first met him at the Napa Wine Auction, where we were able to compare who liked what, and since then we've enjoyed lots of wines together. But more importantly, Chuck has helped to scale Cisco to what it is today. And 5 years ago, he became the CEO of Cisco. And I don't know how closely any of you have tracked the performance of the company since he became the CEO, but the stock is more than double at its peak since he became the CEO. So my hat's off to you, my friend, for a job well done. So please join me in welcoming Chuck Robbins.
I figured it's a VC thing. I'm up here, I'm like the most casual guy in the room.
Well, we were required to wear jackets.
I told you, I wore one.
So one of the interesting things about the connection between Cisco and Lightspeed is how many of our partners have actually been members of the Cisco team. I mean, Arif himself, many others have been a part of Meredith as an intern many years ago, and so it speaks greatly to the impact that the company has had, not just on Lightspeed, but more importantly, the industry in general. So why don't you start with a simple question or answer. Tell us about yourself. Who the hell are you? Where'd you come from? How'd you get here?
I am originally from Georgia, and I literally grew up on a small farm on a dirt road. And then from there to here, I have no idea. went to the University of North Carolina, got a math degree with a concentration in computer science, and actually was a coder in the 80s, which to people coding today, that wasn't really coding. But but I do understand there's a good demand for COBOL programmers out there right now as we try to transition the old stuff to the cloud. So I did that for a couple years, and then back in the late 80s, it was funny that I was working for what's now Bank of America, and we started looking at these multi-protocol networks, and we started looking at these things called routers. I'm like, I already know what they are. And we did a bake-off between Cisco and Wellfleet. For you young people, you won't remember Wellfleet. They ultimately became part of Bay Networks, which got sold to Nortel, which went the way of Nortel. And we picked Wellfleet, ironically. And then I went to work for Wellfleet, not because we picked them. It was a few years later. And we literally picked them because they had 16 meg token ring support 45 days before Cisco did or something like that. It was that simple a decision. But anyway, fast forward, I ended up going to work. I worked for Bay. I worked for Ascend Communications for a little while, and then I actually finally got past my religious opposition to going to work for Cisco. And I started as an account manager in 1997 at Cisco.
Wow,
and it's
amazing.
Been quite a ride.
It has been quite the ride. So you've been the CEO now for 5 years.
Just over four.
Just over four. Okay. And as you look back over that history, you've done a number of very interesting acquisitions like AppDynamics, a number of companies that are more software-oriented than Cisco's history. Should one interpret that as a part of the strategy to transform Cisco to become more of a software company, or what?
Yeah, so I think you can ask me later. When I was going through the process, the CEO selection process, we had to write a strategic thesis for what you would do with the company. And I actually documented in there that we I felt like we needed more software content. We needed a higher degree of subscription business. You know, our customers wanted software solutions if they were adequate, and if you didn't need high performance hardware, why build it? When you do need it, build it. And our investors wanted more predictability, so they wanted software subscription models. So we set out to do it, and you know, I'll tell you that we I started talking about the fact that I thought we could build a subscription business on top of Ethernet switches. Hey, you laugh now. If I told you how much we have on top of them now, you wouldn't. Since Press is here, I have to keep that number to myself. But we literally started in the middle of 2017. We launched our enterprise campus switching portfolio for the first time with a mandatory subscription. And on the first product that we did that on, it actually became the fastest ramping product in the history of Cisco.
Wow.
And so, you know, the whole question of whether we could support a subscription, and I can tell you what the key things we thought about as we did that. Now all our wireless access points, our switches, and our enterprise routing platforms all have mandatory subscription models on them. So that's one thing. And so that was the strategy. And then everybody likes the acquisitions we make that are software oriented, and I tell them, of course it aligns with the strategy, but the other part that's true is most companies that you guys are starting happen to be software companies, and they happen to be subscription companies. So it just works.
And so how has the business model shifted then over that 4+ year period?
Yeah, we have, we've made significant progress. We have a significantly higher percentage of our product business today that's software than what it was when I started, and a substantial portion of that. In Q4 of this past year, 70% of all of our software sold in Q4 was a subscription or SaaS. And it is, we're on the journey. I mean, we're a big company, so. But we, at the same time last year, we eclipsed $50 billion for the first time in history. We had a record year, and that was after we divested of $2.8 billion in revenue after I became CEO. So it's, so far it's working. We've had a good economy, and we had tax reform. Those things didn't hurt.
Yeah, right.
But it's still early.
It always is early in tech. So when you think about Cisco and you look at its history, it's probably been one of the most active acquirers of early stage companies and most successful acquirers of early stage companies in the Valley. So how do you make the choice between organic and inorganic growth, and what drives you to lean more one way or the other?
Yeah, and I'll tell you that you either miss something and you need to go buy it, and we're trying to minimize the number of times we have to do that, but they do exist. There are times when you don't know how a certain part of the market is going to evolve, and so you know you want to be in it, but you're going to let you guys experiment and find a path, and then we will see what's becoming successful and then go that route instead of trying to invest in four or five different options to see how things play out. That's one scenario. Another is to enter a new market, a new part of the market like AppDynamics was for us. And then there's tech and talent deals that just bring new capabilities to our portfolio that we have today. So it's all those things. And how do we think about organic versus inorganic? We want to build everything we can build, but we have a fixed, even as big as we are, we have a fixed expense envelope. So there are things that, and what you tend not to get are people that are running the day-to-day big businesses. They don't have the cycles to do some of the breakthrough stuff. So you either have to set up a different methodology of getting to some of the breakthrough stuff, or we obviously leverage the inorganic route as well.
Well, it's clear that inorganic growth is important to a lot of people in this room because they, quite frankly, are owners or founders or whatever of young companies. So how would you advise the CEOs or leaders of these companies to think about being acquired and being integrated into a larger company? What advice would you give them? Other than pray.
Well, no, I think, obviously you have to build great technology or great solutions and something that customers are obviously embracing significantly. I think the question for us increasingly is, getting something to scale in the enterprise is difficult. And it's it's rarely the technology that's the problem. It's the actual go-to-market and the just getting it into the customer base. So, you know, what we've begun to do is actually we've built some partnerships with some startups that we really like their technology, and we can help them scale through our ecosystem. I mean, we have like 68,000 partners around the world. And it's impossible. I mean, you're on Microsoft's board. They have a similar kind of capacity globally. It's just very difficult. So I think that, you know, figuring that out and probably doing it through some partnerships is the right answer. When you go in, I think the thing that we're always worried about is that most of you want to do this again and again and again, and you actually don't want to stay and run these things. And so making sure that there's a real clear understanding of how, and that you care about the long-term viability of the asset once it's in the large enterprise, because we've walked when we didn't feel we had a path to get there, and we were afraid that the founders would split, and we didn't see how it might last. And when you're smaller in a big company like ours, that's a super important thing to figure out and make sure you have nailed down, or you've just wasted money.
Well, many of the founders here would love to have a relationship with Cisco, not necessarily be acquired by Cisco at this point, because recognizing that you can, in fact, buy a lot of the technology that they have in their portfolio. That being said, the most difficult challenge for almost everyone in tech right now is all around go-to-market. Mm-hmm. More importantly, all around the talent pool that's available or not available in the go-to-market side of the business. You led that part of Cisco for a long time. Can you comment on where you think the market is? And candidly, how does a big company like Cisco compete with a small company like a lot of these startups who really can move maybe a little bit faster than you?
I think you just have to be realistic about who you're gonna recruit and who wants to work with you. Look, there are people who love working for small startups, and there are people who love building careers with us. And I mean, that's just a fact. I was at a point in my career where I loved a small company, and then I started having a family, and I said, you know what, I need to get some security here and kind of settle in. And so I think it's just the reality is people are at different places, and you just have to know that, and it's okay. And when we have people that find themselves in a situation where they're not satisfied, that's all right. We can help them find a place where they are, even if it's outside. We actually have begun to work with our teams where if we have an area of our business that isn't performing and we need to de-invest from that area, we're now building a process where we're trying to let the employees know ahead of time that this is a challenge for us because it's not happening. And then we're working a process internally to try to place them, and then we also have our partner network that we're actually integrating with to help them find places in that. So there's a lot of things you have to do. And what I tell people today, in particular across the whole talent spectrum, is there are so many places where you can work and you're going to be challenged, you're going to make good money, and the big thing that you have to figure out is where are you going to love what you do, and where do your values align with the values of the company that you work for. There's plenty of places you can make money. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want 5% more every 2 years than you can make over here, then you can jump around. But you know, that's the thing, is finding a place that you really enjoy and have fun and trust and the values align.
Well, it's not easy these days to acquire talent in tech, regardless of what it is, be it sales or engineering or any other. But you've learned a great deal from the acquisitions that you've done, not just as CEO, but even in your job running the field team. So what advice would you give these founders as they think about building their team and how they should integrate into a bigger company, particularly on the go-to-market side?
Yeah, I think when you're building your team, particularly as you're looking at the go-to-market, you have to be, and you know this, you guys know this better than I do, but I would assume you have to be super surgical about where the high-value use cases are for your technology and stay very focused and not get too distracted and, you know, try to cover too much territory and don't get enamored with, you know, the biggest names on the planet. We joke sometimes that these large companies, when you get into deals there, you go in the procurement guy's office and you slit your wrist, and if you don't bleed to death first, you get the order. So I think being very, very smart and surgical about where you're going to initially do that. And then I think the big thing when you go into these bigger companies is you need to have a real candid conversation about how quickly you integrate. Honestly, we do a lot of thinking about what's the time to integrate. Hmm. Because when you're a functional organization, like we have engineering, we have sales, we have, you know, the easy natural tendency is to take a small company in and then break them up and put them into functions. Yep. And the reality is that usually destroys value. You know, I can speak to that because we've done it. we're actually, particularly right now, we're learning all over again as we acquire SaaS companies who, many of you guys again know this better than I, but these tightly integrated operating models that exist when you start doing this functional, you know, split, you know, it actually breaks the fundamental value of what you bought in the first place. And so we're now working on building a set of criteria that until these companies reach this point, we will not integrate them, you know, like that way. I mean, we may say they got to get to $500 million before we can move them in, because in our business, if you're not that big, you'll get lost and you'll just dissipate. So I think having a real clear understanding of how that's going to work is really important to making sure your team is happy once you get in, because we've made the mistakes, and you know, so.
Well, the shift to the cloud is upon us. It was suggested that we may be 5%, 10% into the journey. But clearly, we are at the very, very early stages. Yeah. There are some interesting young companies, quite frankly, that are emerging to compete with Cisco around security, say Zscaler or Netskope, or even companies that want to translate what you do in hardware into software that lives in the cloud. How do you think about competing with them, and how do you think about the migration of Cisco to a more cloud-based infrastructure?
Yeah, one of the big things that I stood on stage and declared 4.5 years ago was that I named every existential threat to our company and said, we're going to embrace and lead all of them. And at the time, we, you know, SDN, software-defined networking, was viewed to be detrimental. The cloud was viewed to be detrimental. White box was viewed to be detrimental. Disaggregation of hardware and software was viewed to be detrimental. Our building our own ASICs versus using merchant silicon was viewed to be detrimental. And so I basically just have said, whatever transition is going to occur, we're going to lead it, even if it means that we have to disrupt ourselves. And I think that it doesn't mean you're not going to have companies that are going to emerge because we didn't move fast enough a certain area, or, you know, like Zscaler, you know, something like that. You're always going to have that, and you just have to, you have to decide, are you going to, you're going to, do you need to buy something to compete, or do you believe you can build something organically? And in some cases, we understand that we're going to be behind, but we build a strategy to build a comprehensive solution that ultimately will create more value. In that case, as an example, like integrating real tightly our SD-WAN solution with the cloud edge. And I hate to go on longer, but I think the thing that's really interesting to me about the cloud is that every one of our customers, like 6-7 years ago, their whole thesis on moving to the cloud was simplicity, right? And here they are 6-7 years later, and their worlds are more complicated than they were 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the reason is it's simple to understand at this point. It's not one cloud. It's not like the cloud's not like a neighborhood you move to. You know, it's most of our customers are consuming cloud services from multiple cloud providers. They find themselves with 50 to 100 to 200 to 400. I've had one customer tell me they think they're consuming SaaS services from 600 different software companies. Now, I didn't audit it, but nonetheless, it's a lot. So you have this infrastructure that customers built that was fundamentally designed based on a simple premise that traffic originates at the edge, whether it's a mobile user or a branch, and it terminates in a private data center. Gone. And now it's not that we're just routing it somewhere else. We're routing it 600 somewhere else's. Mm. And so the cloud actually has turned into a growth driver for us, because our customers have to re-architect their entire infrastructure to accommodate it. They need automation. They need SD-WAN. They need, you know, they're looking at MPLS networks that they built
a long time ago.
That aren't purpose-built for what they're doing today. So the cloud represents actually more opportunity for us than it does a threat.
Well, an equal opportunity perhaps is 5G. And you've had lots of dialogue and said lots of things externally about 5G. So where are you, and how do you kick Huawei's ass this time?
I'm sure 5G is going to be a key pillar of the 2020 election campaign. I talk about it more from a political perspective than we do about technology. So what's happening right now is that primarily the carriers are building out mid-band 5G consumer services. You'll end up getting 150 meg to your phone, and you'll probably have that by the end of next year. But you won't pay any more for it. So they're going to build these networks out, and effectively by the time we get there, we think that, you know, and I've talked to them about it, they wouldn't argue with that. And then they ultimately want to build, they need to build enterprise class service delivery capabilities off 5G to really, that's where the profit's going to come from. At Mobile World Congress this year, 70% of the customers there said, we're going to make our money off enterprise in 5G. Hmm. And so the role we play is, we don't have radio, which is the least profitable of the whole part of it, which is one of the big reasons we don't have it. But we have everything else. And so, and in fact, we have some announcements coming up in the next 45 days with some new platforms that, you know, if you think about building out true enterprise class 5G services, and the consumer side, the stress on the core network, the backbone network, and the internet in general is going to go through the roof. So we've actually been building some platforms for almost 5 years that we're actually just going to bring to market. I mean, these things take a while. And so that's a big part of it. And then helping our service provider customers deliver enterprise services is a big value proposition we've had with them for a very long time. So helping them actually think about how do you deliver enterprise services over either fixed or mobile 5G networks, the whole IoT and industrial, you know, the private LTE solutions, there's just a whole bunch of them that are going to come around. I think that's probably going to be, I think that's the 2021 when you really see that stuff coming out, because they're so focused on getting the consumer rate thing done.
So 2020 is the year that we'll really start to see 5G. 2021 is when it'll hit the enterprise?
I think that's when it'll start hitting the enterprise.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think next year is going to still be mostly about the consumer. You'll see some build out, but I think it'll be the year after.
All right, so this conference is all about scale.
Yeah.
And we ask every participant up here on the platform to share with us the experience you had where scale really did change the way you think about yourself and your company. What did you learn? What was one of the most important things you learned about scaling a business?
There's so many lessons learned. When you're big and you make a mistake, it hurts big, right? The one thing that we have had to really grapple with over the last few years is our history has been that we build for the high-end enterprise, which means we build for 1,000 features from the first day a product ships, right? And you guys are probably grinning because that's like the opposite of what you do today, right? And so, but that's our culture. It's been built in forever. So we want to build it for what JP Morgan needs, you know? And so we're having to think differently about that. We need two different methodologies. We need stuff for them because they definitely want what they want. But then we've begun to embrace the MVP process of, hey, if you want, when you were asking about cloud earlier, we're now built, you know, our stuff is like, we have a cloud management platform called Meraki, which is a company we bought. They were $70 million in bookings when we bought them 7 years ago, 6.5, 7 years ago, and I think they're close to $3 billion now.
Wow.
Wow. And so that was one we did right, by the way.
How can you tell?
I probably won't mention the other ones up here, but and you know, now we're looking at building a cloud management platform for our more traditional feature rich networking platforms. And so we start with, okay, I got to build this massive thing, and now we're revisiting it, saying, hold on, maybe we say if you want cloud management across the traditional Cisco, you're going to get these first, you're going to get 50 features, and if that's good enough, then this is good. If it's not, you need to go over here. And so that's one of the things that we've had to think about, really scaling and moving faster and developing in today's world. But the other thing is that, you know, the go-to-market scale is a huge competitive advantage, and it's one that we protect. I mean, we had our annual partner summit this week, and we're making this shift to subscriptions, we're making this shift to customer success and all this stuff, and our partners are like, well, does this mean they're going direct, you know? I mean, this is... And so I stood on stage and told them, I said, ironically, you guys are worried about this, and in our last fiscal year, we had the highest percentage of our business go through our partner community than we have in the last 6 years, so just calm down. We're sticking here. But that's a huge differentiator that we have to protect. And in fact, most smaller tech companies we talk to either about acquiring or partnerships, one of the things they want is the sales ecosystem, because that is the most difficult thing to and the most costly thing to replicate. In fact, if you look at a lot of startups who do go public, that ultimately, the reason they're upside down on their P&Ls is it's sales and marketing costs. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to ever get out of it. And so what happens is when these companies go public, a lot of times you see them, you know, you're given all the leeway you need as long as you're growing 60%. And then you miss once or twice, and then all of a sudden they say, okay, now you need to be a real company. And you can't spend like that. And then you just lose any ability to build out the scale. So mm-hmm. It's become clear to me that the go-to-market scale on a global basis is hugely important.
So while that would normally be the last question, I want to circle back on one other, which is all about advising our portfolio companies. What does a successful acquired CEO look like and behave like when he or she comes into Cisco?
I'll be honest with you. By the time we get to where we're talking to, the technology's probably fairly clear. And for me, then, it's a culture fit. It's a cultural fit. And look, I believe deeply that companies have a different responsibility than we had a decade ago. And so I'm looking for people who we share values. You know, we have... Like we stepped in 2 years ago and donated $50 million to Destination Home in Silicon Valley to combat homelessness. Mm-hmm. We have over 2 million students that'll go through our Cisco Academy education programs this year. We've taken it into prisons. We're taking it into orphanages. And so, I mean, we have a real belief in that. And where we find, like, I'll give you an example. Duo. You guys know Duo? Doug Song and John, just perfect, because they care about the same things. And it doesn't matter how small you are. And I think this is something that all of you are going to have to think about as you build your business, because the challenge of the technology and whatever you're trying to build is great. But, you know, people spend so much time. I think the lady that was up here before was talking about how much time you spend at work. And people are increasingly wanting to intertwine some part of, you know, I want some mission in this whole thing, right? And so when we look for companies, we've walked away from companies where they were beautiful technical fits, beautiful. I mean, it hurt me to walk away. But it just, like, the CEO cultural thing just wasn't gonna work. And so that's a big thing that I think we need to look for. And, you know, we've worked hard over the last
few years.
So
how do you find that? Because I will admit, the failure in my acquisition of Veritas was the cultural mismatch between the two companies, quite frankly. So how do you determine whether or not there is a good cultural fit between Cisco and the company that you are contemplating?
Well, you have to spend time with the leaders, and you have to... You know, at some point you have to trust your instincts that what you're hearing is sincere if you're hearing the right things, but you can usually tell, right? I'll tell you one of the things we've worked hard to do. I had three big buckets of things when I became CEO that I wanted to do. One was the business model transformation. Two was I wanted to amp up innovation to a much higher rate than we had been delivering on. The third was I wanted to amplify culture. Hmm. inside the company. And we started doing a few things. And you know, we were blessed, like 2 months ago, Great Places to Work came out and they rated the top global workplaces in the world, and we were number one. And it was I actually wrote in my thesis to the board when I was competing for the CEO. And you know how you do this, right? You're writing this, you're like, well, I mean, obviously, we'd like to be the best place to work in the world. It's like, well, shit, we did. We did it. How about that? But I think that's a byproduct of people feeling good. We've just, like, everybody wants to do good stuff, right? We live in a world where we're inundated with negativity all day long, every day, right? All the headlines are negative. Everything everybody talks about are negative. And 98% of what's happening in the world is actually good.
Positive.
But we don't talk about it. Yeah. And so we have really unleashed, our employees are like doing so much in their local communities. I mean, we've launched these global impact awards, we've launched innovation challenges, we found a woman in North Africa who's running an orphanage for children. And we had a lady in Oakland who had created a home for victims of sex trafficking in their spare time, right? And so we're just like pouring fuel on these things to help them do that. And the other thing I think you'll find as you continue to go, and some of you have done this before, so this is redundant, I apologize, but in today's world, your employees are going to expect a different level of engagement and opinion on things than they did 5 to 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if you're small enough that they don't yet, they will. And all of your employees can become activists. And so we did something when I became CEO. I felt like we needed to communicate more frequently to our employees. So we started this thing, and it's 1 hour once a month, and we leverage all our video stuff, and we have 20,000-30,000 connections in some months, and some of those are conference rooms, so there's multiple people sitting in them, and we call it the Cisco Beat. And we literally do 30-35 minutes of content on topics that matter. Some we've talked about mental health, we'll do a product launch, we'll talk about, you know, a compensation program, or we'll talk about work on homelessness or whatever it is. And then we do 20-25 minutes of just open, unfiltered Q&A. Yeah. And I have been asked.
Do you filter the questions?
No.
Good.
Well, you can't filter them when there's microphones standing up and people get up out of their chairs in the room you're in and they walk to the microphones, or we go to a remote video location and they're going to ask what they're going to ask.
There's some companies, though, in this industry that require that you submit the question ahead of time and they scan it and then only ask those that they think are appropriate.
Yeah, and your employees walk out completely unfulfilled by the BS.
I agree.
And so it's... I've told our guys two things. If it won't put me in jail or put our company at risk, I will answer any question you ask. And I have answered questions over the last few years about bathroom bills, Muslim bans, immigration, why the hell are you in the White House, separation of families at the border, I mean, on and on. I mean, everything. And we've created a level of trust where we can talk about really complicated stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's part of why we ended up with this award, because our employees actually, you know, gave all the input. But I think that's what your people are going to want. And it's just the way I think it's going to be very important in the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chuck Robbins.
Thank you guys.
Awesome. Chuck, thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Good to see you.
If you want to find out more about Chuck Robbins, you can find him on Twitter, @ChuckRobbins. Thanks again for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please go to iTunes or wherever you're listening to and rate and review it. You can also find us at tbtpodcast.com. Tomorrow Built Today is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. The theme music you heard today is by Mikhail Manvalin.